This is Watch on Lake Bible School 2014. This is our Tuesday night evening program, and our brother Mark O'Grady will be speaking to us on the title, The Vatican Exposed. Our reading has been Revelation chapter 18, verses 1 to 13. Brother Mark.
Thank you, Brother Chairman. I just thought I'd start with a little advertorial. Just a few photographs of New Zealand and a little bit about our ecclesia and the family we've left at home and a couple of aspects of New Zealand. For those that don't, have many of you been to New Zealand? Hands? There's a few, actually. There's a few. Excellent. Very good. And is it always sunny in New Zealand? Never rains? The White Houses came to our summer Bible school at the beginning of this year, and it rained non-stop every day bar one, where it only rained for half a day. It was extraordinary. So this is a little different, isn't it? Okay, there's obviously two islands, the North Island and the South Island. New Zealand exists as an accident of collision between two tectonic plates. So on this side you have the Pacific Plate, and here we have the Tasman Plate. The South Island has a row of mountains, the Southern Alps, which starts here and basically finishes here. So that's mountain all the way through there, and some very high mountains through there, magnificent mountain scenery. What happens in the South Island is the two islands collide and go up. In the North Island, the two plates collide and one goes under the other. It's a subduction plate. And that's where we tend to get volcanoes and the boiling mud pools around this area here, or actually through there. And right out to here, there's a big volcano out here as well. Auckland itself is built on seven extinct volcanoes. So it's from a geological point of view, it's an extremely active country. I'll talk about that a little bit more. From an ecclesial point of view, the main ecclesial centres are obviously in the cities. There's four ecclesias up in Auckland. Auckland's the biggest city in the country, about 1.2 million. We've got three ecclesias in Wellington. There's one in Napier, a little one in New Plymouth, one in Wanganui, Palmerston North and so forth, Hamilton, and a few other little ones around. But there's three ecclesias in Wellington. There's three or four ecclesias in Christchurch, a couple of ecclesias down here, one in Dunedin, Nelson. So they're sort of scattered around. Now, in terms of distance, a number of you asked about Roger Lewis and whether Brother Roger is in our ecclesia. No, we are in the Tower Ecclesia, which is in Wellington City. Population of Wellington is about 400,000, thereabouts. Brother Roger is in one of the ecclesias in Christchurch, so it's a three-hour ferry crossing across here and about a 4.5 to 5 hour drive to get down the island to where they live. So you, Brother Skip, that was telling me what the rainfall is in this part of the world?
In Vernon, it's about 13 inches a year.
About 13 inches a year. Okay. Apart from my teen class, who aren't allowed to answer, this area here is called Fiordland. Does anybody know what the rainfall is in there? What was it? What did you say? 17 metres a year. Isn't that extraordinary? It's damp. Okay, that's the Tara Ecclesial Hall. It's not a great photo in terms of getting a perspective of the hall, but it's obvious why we put that photo in. It's not every day you can organise a rainbow over the top of the Ecclesial Hall. We've had the hall for probably about 10 years. The ecclesia was set up about 12 years ago, and we have about 40 members thereabouts. That's one of our ecclesial camps. We had a brother down from Auckland leading a series of studies, so that's our ecclesia on the Sunday at the ecclesial camp. As you'll see, our forest is quite different from yours. It's very dense because of the rainfall. The undergrowth is extremely dense, and getting through the undergrowth is very difficult. That's inside the ecclesial hall. And that's doing what Christadelphians do so well, a potluck dinner. We do one of those once a month after a memorial meeting. We all pool food, and that was the Sunday before we came away. Now, a couple of people have asked me if I'm related to Brother Brian O'Grady. The answer is yes, rather directly. It's my father. And that's Brian and Joyce, my parents, and one of my nieces there as well. And some of you may have met my brother Simon. That's Simon and Cindy and two of their children. They've got four children in total. That's our youth group, fundraising night with a cafe. Okay, and that's the rest of our tribe. So six children. You may recognize Hannah and Amy, who are here with us this week. David's our oldest. He's 27. Then Daniel, who's 25. Jonathan, who's 20. And James, who's 18. So apart from David, obviously, who's married, all the others are still at home. So when I'm talking from time to time in the studies about the busyness of a mum in a household, yeah. Okay, so those are the three boys that are still at home, Daniel, Jonathan, and James. And that's David, our oldest. He married Sister Leah. She was Sister Leah Bowden from the Te Tiru Gully Ecclesia. They have one little boy called Benjamin, and they have another baby due the week we get home. So as you can imagine, there's a slightly anxious grandmother here this week. We don't teach them to feed very well. He found the cream bowl when Mum wasn't in the kitchen. And next one I'm going to be working on is Eureka. Okay, that's home. A strange thing in New Zealand, all the houses are made of timber. With the earthquakes, brick doesn't work very well, and timber's always been plentiful. This is actually a very old place that we bought. Somebody had a big section in town, and they wanted the section, had a lot of trees on it, and they didn't want the old house. They said, get rid of it, and we said, sure. And they actually cut it down the middle with a chainsaw, and it was shifted on some huge trucks and moved on site. Gives you a bit of a feel here for the hills. It's very hilly. Because of the tectonic plates and the collision of the tectonic plates, it's rare to get flat land. We shifted 7,000 cubic metres of soil to get a flat platform there. The only reason we could do that is we did it at the same time they were doing a subdivision there as well. That's home. Coming down the driveway to our place, that's looking up the valley, and it gives you again a bit of a feel for the terrain, what the countryside is like. It stays green most of the year round. These hills might dry off a little bit. One of the things I've found fascinating about this part of the world is how things under the white blanket of snow go brown and grey, so that for you, spring is a magnificent symbol of the resurrection. We don't get that. The coldest we get to is about 3 degrees. Every now and again you might get a frost, but generally the coldest, most unpleasant day in winter would be 3 degrees. It can be a horrible wind and rain, and the hottest we get is 28. So it's a very, very narrow band. It means we don't get the beautiful seasons, the very real seasons that you get here. But it's quite mild at the same time. That's boys doing what boys do. Now this one, a few of you may have seen this from some years back. This is quite old now, but I wanted to prove that we do have some animals in New Zealand, but they are introduced. That's the Australian brush-tailed possum, or opossum. And there's 4 million people in New Zealand, and at one stage they reckon there are about 70 million of these little critters. With intensive control, they've got down, they reckon, to 55 million. I don't know how they did the census. They have magnificent fur, but they also love gardens, fruit trees, and all the native bush. They eat all the fruit, the flowers, the new shoots on the trees. They can kill an 800-year-old tree. 30 of them will descend on a tree, and they'll just keep chewing off all the new growth on it, and they can kill an 800-year-old tree. And that's Amy with the produce from the garden. And I just thought I'd pop in a few photographs at the end here. That's actually Christchurch. That's the city that Brother Roger lives in. Now that's a picture of downtown Christchurch as it is now. Now if you think of downtown Vancouver, with all your high-rise buildings, that's what this was. And they demolished 1,500 buildings out of the CBD. Just extraordinary. And a lot of those were quite modern buildings. They just didn't handle the movement with the earthquake. A few people have asked, is everything back to rights now? The rebuild is just starting 3 years later, and there are thousands of households who still haven't had an insurance payout. So it's a really painful, slow process, and there are brothers and sisters whose homes have to be rebuilt or have still been waiting for repairs to be done. So just a real grind. It's just sort of ground the city down over many, many years. There were two buildings in particular which fell down, which caused a large number of the deaths. I could be wrong, but I think there's about 185 deaths in the city as a whole. This is a comparatively new building. Turned out the engineer wasn't properly qualified and didn't follow engineering rules. And the council signed it off, as did his boss that owned the engineering company. And that was the net result during the earthquake. The buildings that got most badly destroyed were churches. Made of brick and stone, very old, and they didn't handle the shaking too well. And this last one here is quite an interesting one. It's a bit of an older building, the Pine Gold Guinness building. That's where quite a few people died. But that one has a particular relevance to us because my brother worked about there. And he was made redundant. He had a great job, really enjoyed it, and they made his job redundant about 2 or 3 months before the earthquake. And we felt really sorry for him when he lost his job. And he was devastated. It was a great job, really enjoyed it. And 2 or 3 months later, we were dumbfounded. Because he went to the funerals of his staff. And for me, that's just one of those extraordinary indications that you get sometimes in life when you say, you know, things happen in life and we don't know why, but the Father always does. So for me, I'll never forget that. It's a pretty stark reminder to me of the way in which the Father works in people's lives. Okay, so that's just, as I say, a little bit of an advertorial with a suggestion that any of you who haven't been down clearly need to at some stage. Okay. All right, Brother Paul read for us from the book of Revelation and chapter 18. What we're going to do tonight is take a little bit of a different visit to the Vatican. I find that description quite blood-chilling, really, when it talks about the merchandise of gold, silver, precious stones, pearls, etc., etc., iron, marble, cinnamon, odors, ointments, frankincense, slaves, and the souls of men. And it's almost sort of an ominous ring to those words, isn't there? A system that trades in the souls of men. And that's what we're going to have a look at tonight. We're going to look at the Vatican, particularly St. Peter's, the Vatican Museum next door to it, and just a few of those things around Rome, based on a trip that we took there. It's quite a few years ago now. It was actually just towards the end of the life of Pope John Paul II. You'll meet him tonight. So it's a little while ago, but I found it a truly fascinating experience when we know what this system is like, the dreadful and terrible beast, the evil and terrible beast of Daniel, and when you see that city and you see her sitting as a queen saying she's no widow, it really certainly does something in terms of turning the stomach. Now, have many of you been to the Vatican? Is that of interest? Show of hands? So there's a few through here. You may have other stories that you want to contribute as we go through. That's absolutely fine. And feel free to ask any questions as we go through as well. Our perspective was given to us by a young lady who was our tour guide. And she had a major in art history. She spoke with an American accent, so I'm not sure whether she was someone who'd spent many years in America or quite how it worked, but she was of Italian extraction. And so she took us through explaining to us the history behind the artworks and the items in St. Peter's. And I found it really quite fascinating. I have met brothers and sisters who said that they went through St. Peter's and they came out feeling physically sick, and they came out feeling really upset and distressed. I've heard of people in the world who have gone through that tour and come out convinced that Catholicism is right. Well, we came out laughing. Seriously laughing. How on earth could you believe in that system? It's just a monument to three things: avarice, lust, and pride. You have a look as we go through and see if you come to the same conclusion. Okay. Right, a little bit of an overview first of all. So that's St. Peter's sitting there, and that's obviously the area in front of St. Peter's, the square where a lot of the photographs get taken. What sits through here is the Vatican Museum. The Pope, up until the last one, used to live in this building just here. The last one, I think, is still living in a hotel, isn't he, to make the point that he's not going to live as his predecessors did in a life of luxury sitting in here. There's a very interesting little place here, which is a much more modern building. We're going to go in there to meet the Pope tonight. And this is obviously part of the Vatican City or the Vatican State itself. Now, I think what I'm going to do is move that so that I can change this more readily as we go through. Okay, if that falls out at any stage, we'll suddenly lose what we've got, but let's see how we go. Okay, so that's actually a visual photograph of the whole thing. We're going to come in, after having a look around, we're going to look up at the front of the building, we're going to look back down here, down to the river, and we're also going to, when we came to the Vatican City, we caught the underground there, and we came up in a street down here, and we came through, and you'll see from the end of that street, looking up here, through those huge colonnades, into this area here as well. Oops, that didn't work. Sorry about that. Pushed the wrong button. Okay, so we've come out and we're looking down the street, and what you can see there in the distance is the walls around that area of St. Peter's Square and the big colonnades through to it as well. As we get a little closer, you can see that actually it's rather massive. Look at the width of those columns and the size of it there. Really quite huge. Once you go through those columns, looking back the way you've come, that's the way we came, was down through that gap there, and you can see the size and the height of the columns around that area. Okay, does anybody know where the columns came from? This gives it away a bit. What's that? The Colosseum. So those columns, which are sitting around St. Peter's Square, that area in front of St. Peter's, those columns were pinched from the Colosseum. Now the Colosseum is a rather interesting building. That's looking at it from inside. In fact, if I just go back, you'll probably see, you can actually see columns up on there. See those columns all the way through? So some of those columns were taken and used to form that that round section at the front. The Colosseum is a very interesting place. We had 2 days in Rome, and the first day we went to have a look at Old Rome. Now, Rome's quite fascinating, because when they say go to visit Old Rome, it's fenced off. It starts with the Colosseum, and you go through past the Arch of Constantine, up over the hill past the Arch of Titus, the one that has the menorah on it being carried away into captivity, drop over the hill, and you're into literally the area of the old city of Rome. And it's extraordinary to look, it was quite small, but to look at these buildings that were the heart of the Roman Empire from so long ago. And they've excavated them all, and they're sitting there. It's really quite fascinating to watch. But we'd been told that you have to be very careful in Rome because of pickpockets, and don't trust people when they try and badger you to sell you things. So we were queuing up in a nice tidy fashion to go into the Colosseum, and someone came up to us and said, oh, come with us, we'll take you on a tour. And you sort of hold on to your bags and your cameras and say, no. Off they shuffle, and they're hassling people in the queue. And they come back, and you sure you don't want to go on a tour? And we're saying, no, no, no. Well, the third time they came back and they said, would you mind telling us why not? They said, it's free. We'll take you straight to the front of the queue and you get a free tour around the ancient Rome. Oh, okay. And they took us through. And it was actually really quite interesting. Now, the facts which they told us were in terms of the numbers and stats, and I'll go through them here. I've also tried recently to do a little bit of independent corroboration on that great research device called the internet, and you find some of the numbers there are competing claims around them, but I'll tell you the numbers which they told us. Basically, in this area here, because if you were a citizen of Rome, as we know from scripture, you had some privileges, and one of those was that you didn't pay any tax. In fact, many of them didn't have to work. Now, if you were an emperor and you had a city full of people who didn't have to work, you had trouble on your hands. So what the emperors did was entertain the people. So the Colosseum was built for the entertainment of the masses, so they'd be satisfied and not cause trouble. You've heard of Circus Maximus with the chariot races and all those sorts of things. It was all laid on as free entertainment. There was free immorality, there was free alcohol in these places. It was basically a scene of debauchery. Now, this was designed as a place of entertainment. You can see in it the precursor to the modern sports theatre, can't you? The stadiums all around the world in which the masses in so many countries go to worship these days. When you look at it here, the Colosseum was originally designed as a floating theatre. So this area here was originally filled up with water. So they could put full-scale replicas of ships in there and have military campaigns and fights for the entertainment of the masses. They had a few problems in terms of holding water, and they were finding it was quite hard to maintain. So they put a false floor across it and turned it into an arena for killing beasts and particularly humans. Now, the guide that we had gave us a figure. She said it was an operation, this little place here, for about 400 years. Now, I've seen conflicting demands. The guide we had told us that it was 2 million people. I've seen other accounts that it was 1 million people, give or take 1 million. There's a lot of people that died in this place for the entertainment of the masses, including, of course, probably some of our brothers and sisters. So this is a rather gruesome part of history. Do you know who built this? Not in terms of the emperor. Sorry? Nero, did you say? Started earlier than that. the Jews. The Jews taken from Jerusalem were the slaves that were used to build this. And again, I've heard conflicting numbers in terms of exactly how many there are, but we were told something like 80,000 Jews were used, and probably many of them died in the process, simply to build this place for the entertainment of the masses in Rome. Rather a horrible period in history. Okay, immediately outside of it is that there. Does anybody know what that is? The Arch of Constantine. Okay, so this is built by Constantine to commemorate his triumphs. And of course what he's mimicking there is the Arch of Titus, which is further up the hill, which commemorated Titus's victory, particularly over the city of Jerusalem. Now I want you to keep that picture in mind because you're going to come across it a bit later as well. Okay, so back now to this area here of St. Peter's. And we're going to go down into here. We're going to look up at the facade of the building, and then we're going to look back down the street here as well. Okay, that's looking up at it. That face there is bigger than an American football field. So it's huge. In fact, you can see the people standing here at the base of it. Gives you some appreciation of the scale and the sheer size. Now, I forget the person who started it, the architect that started it, but he died, and Michelangelo then took over. Now, Michelangelo, you're going to hear a bit of him tonight. Michelangelo was clearly a very clever and talented man, but he was also a human pig because of his pride, his own ego was enormous. And he started building this, and as soon as he got involved, he immediately demolished many of the bits that had already been made because he wanted it to reflect his magnificence. He changed the whole structure of the inside of it altogether. He built most of it before he died, but he died before the front facade was built. Before he had died, however, this area at the top, the dome at the top, had been completed. It is enormous. You'll see some more photographs of that a bit later. Everybody in Rome was talking about the magnificence of this huge dome. The man who came along to finish off after Michelangelo was a bit unhappy about the fact that he was just finishing off somebody else's work who was going to get all the glory. So he's actually put an extra layer on the top here, which doesn't have much behind it, so that as you get into St. Peter's Square and look up, that obscures the view of Michelangelo's dome. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, you just wait till you go through and you listen to some of the things sitting in behind it. Okay, so if you suddenly jumped up onto the top of the building and looked back down it, you can see the view down to the river. It's Tiber, isn't it, I think? The river Tiber that flows through Rome there. So again, just gives you a feeling for it. This next picture, that's just looking at ground level back down the same view. Now that picture to me, that just screams out, I sit as a queen and am no widow. Just looks to me like a spider sitting on top of her lair. It's just sitting there, and it looks like a crown, doesn't it? It's all designed to convey something, to convey impressions. Okay, now, if we just go back here, off to the right, and that's that area there, that's where the popes used to live until this current pope. So there's the wing off to the right, and in summer, the Pope would appear up on the balcony in those days to bless the crowds in summer. Of course, we visited there in midwinter, so it wasn't possible for us to see the Pope on his balcony. What they do in midwinter, instead, is they go inside this theatre building here, which seats several thousand people. Now, when we got our tour ticket to go around the Vatican Museum and St. Peter's, you also get a ticket to go into one of the sideshows, which was an audience with the Pope. And so our tour guide took us through security here, and you'll see us going through there shortly, and we snuck in the back, she said, because I just want you to see it, experience it a bit, and then we'll duck out the back. So I don't want to be too far down, it'll cause a bit of a disturbance. So we lined up with everybody else with our ticket to be able to go in and see the Pope. It's a bit like visiting a zoo. So that's us lining up. These fellows here are quite interesting, the Swiss Guard, with their traditional uniform. You can see them again there. Okay, and that's one of them a little closer up. Now, it used to be, if I'm just remembering it right, they had to be over a certain height, they had to be unmarried, there are a whole lot of requirements to be a Swiss Guard. What happened was they stopped being able to get enough people, so they've relaxed the requirements a little, but you still have to be happy to dress up as a clown. Okay, so as you can see, we're sitting down the back. There's several thousand people sitting in this auditorium, waiting for His Holiness to arrive. Now, when His Holiness arrived, you sit there waiting for this grand entrance to take place, this enormously imposing occasion, and what happens? Actually, it's not quite yet. It's a bit blurry, unfortunately, but there are a whole lot of people with funny pink hats sitting down there waiting for Him, and then He arrives on a wheelchair because He was just about dead, literally. He was propped up in a wheelchair, which is His throne, sitting on wheels. Notice this chap's got nice white gloves. I'm not sure what to say. He doesn't get contaminated or vice versa. But He's all dressed up, and He wheels the Pope in on this big... well, it's not quite the Pope-mobile, is it? It's this big wheelchair. And they wheeled Him into position, just like that. Poor old fellow, slumped in his chair. Wheeled Him into position, stuck a little lectern in front of Him, and a sheaf of notes into His hands. And He sat there, slumped in the wheelchair, and read out these messages to us. Just like that. The astonishing thing was, most of the people in the room had come to pay homage to Him. There were people from all over the world. And so as they went through, this fellow here then read out a list of the groups which were represented in his throng that day. And as they read the title out of the group would stand up and sing a hymn to Him, as if He's God. It was amazing. One of the horrible things, really quite horrible things, was some of the things they read out were in German. And we'd just come from the German Bible school. And when we have our brethren praying to our Father and using the phrases about the holiness of God as our Father, to hear those same words in German being read out to this very decrepit old man sitting in a chair was really just quite extraordinary. Quite extraordinary. So he went through to see, and you see these people, they were doing prayers to Him, they were singing to Him. It was obviously an enormously moving experience for them to come in and visit this fellow. Then, it was a little awkward at that point, he then stopped and blessed everybody in the room. So, I have been blessed by the Pope. I'm sorry, I didn't tell you that, Brother Skip, when you first approached me. The only effect that I think it had was the fact that next day when we were supposed to leave, there was a general strike in Rome and we were delayed 8 hours. I'm not sure if that was related to it or not. But, you know, for me, it really just epitomised the whole scene to see these people here worshipping a derelict human figure because of what he represents to them. It was just, it was quite sad, but it was quite extraordinary as well. Okay, what we're going to do now is we left there, we came out, we walked out here and round the side of this building and in through here into the Vatican Museum itself. Now, the Vatican Museum has got quite an extraordinary, that's us walking down the side of the buildings there, and we go into that courtyard and from there inside the Vatican Museum. The Vatican Museum has an amazing array of artifacts, often most of them, of course, from Rome, from Greece, and also from all other places around the world. It's suggested that if you spent 2 minutes in front of every artifact in the Vatican Museum, you'd be there for 12 years. So it's quite considerable. So I'm just going to whip through a few of them fairly quickly and just give you a bit of a feel for the scale of things that are there. This globe here, it's made by a rather well-known artist whose name escapes me. You may notice that it's a globe within a globe. And what it's designed to depict is the inside globe is a representation of the world. Do you know what the outer sphere represents? The Catholic Church. So it's designed to convey the fact that the Catholic Church is all-encompassing all around the world. Okay, so, you turn around and you see at one end this thing here, big pine cone. That is actually the big pine cone. Maybe it's a fir cone, I'm not too good with my conifers. But it was at the end of the Circus Maximus. You just imagine if you're a charioteer and you're thundering around and around and around, you'd lose idea of which way you're facing, wouldn't you, and where you're at. So they had two big devices, this at one end, and I think it was an obelisk actually at the other, which were designed to tell you what side of the circus you're on as you're charging around in your chariots. And here it is here. The reason I found that quite fascinating is because, actually I think it might have been with you, Brother Stephen Palmer, in the British Museum, to see a very ancient relief here. See the pine cone being used to sprinkle holy water? There are some very ancient and pagan roots in a lot of the things that have moved through, actually even into Christianity as well. Actually, it's a pine tree that's used in New Zealand by when they celebrate that rather heathen celebration of Christmas, and they use pine trees. There's some very ancient origins to some of that mythology. Okay, I'm just going to go through. You can just see all the marble sculpture that's all over the place. Now, you look at that. I'll just go to the next one, actually. Now, you might notice, looking a little carefully, that this has got coloured eyes, blue and white eyes. All of these statues, they're made of marble, but they were originally painted. So we think of Greek and Roman statues as just being a hunk of stone. They were actually painted in full lifelike colours. So the clothes were painted, the arms and so forth, the face was painted in flesh colours. They were extremely lifelike figures. The artistry involved in these is quite superb. The best sculpture, they were explaining, came actually from Greece. And the Romans, although they did a lot of sculpturing, never managed to really emulate to the same extent the cleverness of the Greeks with their sculpture. In fact, what happened with some of the Roman sculpture is that they would almost use a production line system, and they would have people carving a separate hand or an arm or a foot, and they would then join them together. So you often see sculptures, some of which are actually nicely and cleanly cut off with pinholes in them where the other bit was actually joined on. And so they were extremely lifelike, and you can imagine why. It's because they're worshipping these different gods and goddesses and so forth. Now, Michelangelo was quite an extraordinary artist. He was an architect, he was a sculptor, and what you think of him often as now is a painter, although, and we'll talk about that later, he actually never had done any painting until quite a long way into his career. He was completely besotted with Greek architecture. Absolutely, or sculptor in particular. And he did a number of the extraordinary sculptures you'll see tonight, and he obviously was an extremely talented artist. I'll just flick through some of these various emperors and Caesars. Mosaics in the floor. Now that little device, this room here has that device in the top right. That's the other side of it. That's the device itself. That's Nero's bath. It's made of Egyptian porphyry stone, which is an extremely dense stone. It was very rare back in the days of the Roman Empire. It was found only in Egypt, and they stripped it all. So there's no porphyry stone anywhere now in the world apart from some of these artifacts that you see. So that was Nero's own personal bath. There's some more of it. That's an interesting little box. Constantine had that box, mate. Inside that box is Helena, Constantine's mother. She was someone who travelled. She went to Jerusalem, various other places. She was an extremely holy woman because she found all sorts of remarkable artifacts, some of which are in St. Peter's now. Those artifacts that were used to convince people that the church indeed was the direct successor from the apostles, and that these relics are used to persuade ignorant people that clearly they had a direct link with God as well. Just some of the ceilings. You can just see walking through all the corridors and hallways, there's just floors and floors of this. It is quite extraordinary and breathtaking. Lapis lazuli stone in the floor there. Incredible mosaics and semi-precious stones used in the flooring. The marbles are interesting. We'll talk about those a little bit later. Now this is a very old Greek statue. This is a statue of Apollos. Michelangelo absolutely fell in love with the statue. Michelangelo was besotted with the human body. He used to break the law and get corpses and dissect them, because he wanted to see how muscle tone worked and that sort of thing. And he did a lot of that to try and understand the structure of the human body so he could put that into his sculpture and his artwork. But he was really besotted with this particular piece of sculpture. And just in your mind, take a mental impression of that face, the face of the god Apollo. Okay, here's another one. This is very, very old, Greek. This is Hercules. Actually, now, I've got to get this right. Yes, Hercules is Greek. Is it, what's the Roman equivalent? I forget now. But anyway, this is Hercules. Now, I want you to look particularly at the muscles around the chest area and also his thighs, because you're going to see those a bit later on as well. Okay, we carry on walking through. There's room after room. This is the room of maps, as you can see. Some very ancient maps. The ceilings are very clever because they're domed, but the way they're painted, the perspective on them doesn't distort it. So there's a lot of skill. Now, this room is really interesting. There's this picture and that picture. Do you know what that is? That, my friends, is the proof for the Immaculate Conception of Mary. Now, I don't know if you know much about the Immaculate Conception of Mary, but it goes like this. The Lord Jesus Christ is God born immaculately through Mary. But Mary has to be clean. So she must have been immaculately conceived as well. And here's the proof. And what's the proof? The writings of the church. It's their own writings down through the centuries stuck into this display case here. And that's their proof of the Immaculate Conception of Mary. It's a good number of years ago, but we got a monthly Catholic magazine turned up in the post. It wasn't addressed to us, I promise, but it was accidentally put on our letterbox. So it was in a paper wrap, so I slid it out and had a read through it. And there was an article in there on the Immaculate Conception of Mary, which I photographed, or photocopied. And as I was flicking through this article, there was a heading which said, Biblical Proof. I thought, oh, this will be interesting. So I started reading it. It said, whilst there is no direct biblical evidence of the Immaculate Conception of Mary, the critico-historical approach does not exhaust the subject. Bible has to be read, and I forget the exact words, but it's along the lines of the Bible has to be read under the guidance of the Church and in the light of the teachings of the Second Vatican Council. It just tells a story, doesn't it? So anyway, this room's dedicated to the proof of that particular doctrine. That just gives you a feel for the insiders we're walking around. This is commemorating. Quite a few of the statues are actually smashed off, like that one of Hercules we saw before, because when the Christians took over under Constantine, they actually went through and smashed a number of the Greek and Roman statues that were around. They tried to demolish a lot of the buildings as well, the pagan temples. Right, now that's not a painting. That's a tapestry. But it's a fairly well-known picture. Does anybody know the history of that picture? Constantine. Constantine is there. What's the story? See this thing here? It's a cross.
By this conquer.
Sorry?
By this conquer.
By this conquer. Excellent. And this black flying serpent dragon thing here was being used by the artist that is a depiction of pagan Rome. Now what this is depicting is the story is that Constantine, the night before, I think it was the Battle of Milvian Bridge, wasn't it, if I remember rightly, when he was battling against Maxentius. Of course, he had found it expedient to have an alliance with the Christians. And so the story goes, although apparently this wasn't told by him until, I've read one account saying it was some two decades after the event, so it's a little bit interesting how we had a temporary memory lapse. But the story that was put out was that he saw a vision of the cross, and that gave him confidence that he was going to win the battle the next day against the forces of pagan Rome, represented here by, appropriately, a flying serpent or dragon. Okay, another battle scene and tapestry. Now this is interesting, and I actually forget what scene it is now, but as you go through, there's a lot of scenes of biblical scenes painted, which you can imagine. But I'm fascinated by the way the artists would paint either, number one, themselves into the scene, number two, their friends or colleagues into the scene, and number three, most particularly, the benefactor who was paying for them to do the painting in the first place. So it's extraordinary how these people suddenly popped up in these biblical scenes. That's Leonardo da Vinci. Strange. It's a biblical scene. I forget what it is now. This is painted by Raphael, I think, from memory. That's him a little bit closer. There's a group of people down in the corner. There's someone looking at you. That's Raphael himself. So these men couldn't paint a biblical scene without just putting their own personal little signature on it, shall we say. I'm in this scene from biblical times. Okay, here's another one. This commemorates there was a fire in Rome, and there was a particular fellow who went in and rescued a number of people and pulled them out of this building. And this painting was painted to depict this young man who went in pulling these people out, who were saved by God through this process. So here's this person who depicts all those who were saved. That's the head of the Pope of the day, who's painted into the scene because he was paying for the picture to be done. And of course it was part of the, I'm not sure if this guy became a saint or something or other in the process, but of course the Pope had to get in on the act as well. Alright, as you walk through the hallways and corridors, you come towards the end, and there's a section where they had a number of pictures here, like this. Now these are pictures of the inside of the Sistine Chapel. Now what do we know the Sistine Chapel for? What was that, sorry? Okay, there's a painting in there, yes, but what particularly happens in the Sistine Chapel? The conclave that elects the Pope. So the Sistine Chapel is an extremely holy place where they elect the new Pope when the previous one dies, or, as we've seen recently, for some reason, abdicates. Now, as we came closer, our tour guide explained to us that when we went into the Sistine Chapel, officially, we were not allowed to take photos. And I thought, okay, I can see that. It's probably a holy place, as far as they're concerned. She said, there's a very important reason for this. A Japanese television station had paid for the restoration, and they had filming rights for 12 years. So she said to us, actually, look, you can take some photos. Don't make a big show of it. And if you get asked to put your camera away, please do, or else we'll be asked to leave. So she took us through the paintings and so forth, and I went in there and I just was standing there with my camera going click, click, click. So the photographs are not of great quality, but that's our guide there. But it'll give you a bit of a feel. That's the side of the Sistine Chapel. You go inside it. Looks like a fortress, doesn't it? That's the ceiling painted by Michelangelo. Now, it's like this. When the Sistine Chapel was being built, the Pope invited several very prominent painters to paint all the insides, walls and the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. The story goes that the two that were invited declined because they'd had a discussion and they knew that Michelangelo's ego was so great that although he had done no painting, he was a sculptor and architect, he couldn't resist the opportunity to stamp his mark on another corner of Rome. And sure enough, when the Pope spoke to him, he volunteered to do it. So what do you do if you've never done any painting before, and that's now your job? Oops. So he hired a crew of art students for a year. And they drew and they painted and all sorts of things all over this place. And he observed them for a year. He then sacked them and took all their work off and painted it himself. In the process, he changed the style of art, became much lighter. He invented a number of new colours and pigments along the way. He was actually an extraordinarily talented man. Now, these are supposed to depict the various scenes of creation, and that's the vaulted ceiling. And there is, and I'm not an expert, but there's some particularly clever things he's done with perspective as it curves in so that it doesn't distort the images at all. It is rather brilliant. A few shots of the walls, ceiling again. And we're going to talk a bit about that painting at the end, that big wall at the end. So let's talk about that now. This scene here is extremely famous. Does anybody know what it's of? It's the final judgment scene. So it's a depiction of Jesus Christ, who is there in the middle. I'm not sure if it's the next picture or not. That's the head on Jesus Christ, Apollo, and that's the body. Just look at the angle of it. It's extraordinary. So he was so besotted with Greek mythology that that's how he painted the Lord Jesus Christ. Now he's in judgment mode. So his mum is there, but she's turning away from him because she's scared of him. Now bear in mind that this is the holy place where they elect the new pope. It's an extremely holy location for them. And here's a depiction of the final judgment scene. Actually, it's a straight depiction of Greek mythology. Even to the extent down here of the river Styx, and two boatmen receiving the souls of the damned, conveying them across the river to the underworld. There is no shame in this. There is no hiding the Greek mythology which he was besotted with. There is no hiding the fact that Catholic philosophy and theory has come straight out of Greek mythology. So you've got the souls of those being accepted going up to heaven, and the souls of the damned going down across the river Styx into hell or purgatory. Okay, what about this fellow here? This fellow here is holding a knife and a dead body and a head. What's that supposed to depict? Well, a poor fellow called John the Baptist who lost his head. So he's depicted there in pride of place, actually in front of Jesus Christ. What about the head? That's the Pope of the day who was paying for the painting. All right, so Michelangelo was an extremely arrogant and proud man. Nobody was allowed inside the Sistine Chapel for the entire duration of the time that he was painting it, because it was going to be a great secret when it was revealed to an admiring throng. One of the cardinals was very naughty. He went inside and had a look when Michelangelo wasn't there. From there he went to the Pope and he complained about the fact that there was a lot of nudity in these scenes. And the Pope's reply was rather extraordinary. I'm responsible for things on earth, the things in heaven and hell are not my responsibility. It's like Pontius Pilate washing his hands. But Michelangelo heard about it. And his pride was so overwhelming, he was utterly incensed. So he painted the cardinal into the picture. Stark naked, sickly, pale and weak, he's one of the boatmen receiving the souls into the river dam, of the damned across the river, and the only privacy he's given is by a serpent that's fastened around him. Now this is supposed to be a holy place. You know what? You know, you can see why I said it's a monument to pride and lust and avarice. It's just extraordinary. Okay, another picture that's there is this. Now this is Saint Peter being given the keys to heaven. Where did this event supposedly take place? In Jerusalem. Can you see what's in the background? Recognize that? The Arch of Constantine. Oh, just to make sure you really get the point, there's two of them. It's just showing the dominance, as they said to us, of Rome over Jerusalem. Except for one thing. The artist put this in from his hometown as well. Okay, I need to start speeding up here a little bit. Okay, there's a number of front doors into St. Peter's. I won't go through the history of all of those, but they have some extraordinary history. You go in through the front, and that's looking straight down the front. As you look down, and it's huge, the building's constructed inside by a series of arches. So it means you get a colonnade, you can run down through here, or then on the other side of these posts, excuse me, likewise down that way, and crossways as well. So there's views disappearing off in all sorts of directions. That's the main area straight through there. Okay, as you come in the front door, on the left is this very well-known painting. It's very dark there, unfortunately, by Raphael. Now it's the Transfiguration, and you can't see it very well there, but up here is the Lord Jesus Christ. And he's appearing in glory with these two either side of him. Now, who do you think's the most dominant person in that painting? Would it happen to be a lady in pink? Let's have a look a little bit closer. Who are they all looking at? The lady in pink. You know who that was? That was Raphael's mistress. Okay, you come in the front door, you turn right. There's a very famous statue called La Pietà. And it's a statue, it was done by Michelangelo, it's very clever. It's a statue of Mary holding Jesus Christ. You get a bit closer, and there are people praying for this, by the way. And seriously, praying, bowing down and praying in front of the statue, kissing their hands and blowing to it. Now, again, the sculptor here is quite clever. To get perspective, if this lady stood up, she'd be about 9 feet tall. It's very clever with things like she's got cloth between her hands and the body to show how holy it is, etc., etc. When Michelangelo was commissioned to do this particular sculptor, the Pope said, it's not to be attributed. Maybe he was getting offended by Michelangelo's ego by that stage, I don't know. But it's for the glory of God, so it's not to be attributed. When it was unveiled, all of Rome was completely agog at this magnificent new sculpture that had turned up. About 3 weeks later, a lesser-known sculptor started a rumour that had been painted, that had been sculpted by himself. Now, how do you reckon Michelangelo was going to handle that? Not too well. So he broke in. Can you see some writing here on the sash? He carved across the sash of Mary. Michelangelo made this. And they pray to it. They pray to it. It's just extraordinary. This poor woman here, she was kissing her hand and striking the cross. I'll keep whipping through. Okay, let's head down there to this, and I forget what it's called now, but this huge, great big, this big edifice there. We'll have a look a bit closer at it as we get further down there. Oh, along the way, you come across another piece of porphyry stone, which was moved there, actually. It was on that piece of porphyry stone that Charlemagne was crowned as emperor. In the floor, of course, you come across the Pontifex Maximus. There's a whole lot of very ancient titles used, but I found these interesting. Ecclesia Cordis Jesu Brussels. It's the name of a church in Brussels. Now, all the way down through that particular section of the building, you find these little markers. So, for example, St. Paul's Cathedral from London has got its own little marker that's there. And there's a lot of prominent churches have their own little marker there. And the guide said to us, oh, this is because it's ostensibly because... it's a reflection of the fact that, you know, we're all encompassing, she said. But actually what it does is it measures the distance from the beginning down to here of the size of their church compared to ours. And it's making the point that it's the biggest church in existence. She said, except in the Ivory Coast, they made an exact replica of St. Peter's on a scale exactly the same. You know what happened? The Pope refused to sanctify it because they had impoverished the poor to build it. Just remarkable. Okay, I'm just going to flick through these rather quickly. Now, in the middle of this area here, you've got that great big edifice. In fact, Brother Stephen had a picture of these cardinals lying down in front of the Pope. I've got a picture, a similar one, taken at a different time, which is actually the Pope's underneath this area here. But you can see this is the central dome. It's absolutely enormous. When you get a bit closer to it and look up into it, it goes up and then it disappears into an area way up the top. Now, for some reason, some of that hasn't appeared properly on the screen. I think, oh, that's it, right up the top there. That huge, big, brass-looking canopy can fit entirely in that. The top of that is about 10 stories high. So this is a massive building. It's really huge. Okay, that's it a little closer. You can see the emblem of the sun god. That's a big alabaster circle to represent the sun, and there's a dove right across the middle of it. To give you a bit of a feel for the scale of it, there's the Pope. There's these people, priests being presented in front of the Pope. That's one of the pillars of that device. So you can see the size of it. Now, all around the corners around here are some extremely important artifacts. That's a little bit more about it. See the sun image in the middle of the top with the bird again? Okay. Around the outside, there are these four stations. That one, I think, is the one that has a piece of the cross. This one here, notice the spear? It apparently has the tip of the spear that was used to jab into the side of the Lord Jesus Christ. And the story goes that the man that thrust the spear and instantly converted to become a Catholic And all of these artifacts, there's a piece of shroud, all of these artifacts are used as proof of their infallibility. Now, you may have heard of this one. That's the very time-honored tradition, an extremely ancient tradition of kissing the foot of what was originally Jupiter, is now St. Peter, and you kiss and stroke the kiss your hand, stroke the foot, and as a result, the foot's just about worn away. For good luck, someone touched the other foot as well, so he's losing his toes. I'm not quite sure what that person's actually trying to say as he's standing there, but he's just made himself very happy. Okay, then there are some tombs in the middle of St. Peter's, around the side. There's a number of the popes that have actually got their own tombs up in St. Peter's on ground level, as it were. I forget the name of the pope that's buried here. He's a rather short man, and the entrance to the tomb was quite short. The marble here, I mean, you've seen the marble everywhere. That was all stripped out of the pagan temples. So when St. Peter's was built, they actually went into the pagan temples. The temples are still there in ancient Rome. You can still see the buildings. And they just stripped the marble off and used it to make this edifice. But that's him up the top there, and he's surrounded by four women. And I forget what they represent, truth and virtue and something or other else. But the one on the right there is rather interesting. Now, unfortunately, my photo is rather blurry. But she's standing there, and what you can't see very well there is that's her foot. And her foot is standing on a globe. Now, of course, this intricate piece of artwork has to be held together by pins. And there's a pin which goes through from the heel of her foot through England, which had broken away about 100 years before from the Catholic Church. Now, when you read the Catholic Church's version of it, she's standing there with a thorn going into her foot, which comes from England, which broke away from the Catholic Church. This one, I enjoyed this one. This is another tomb. The Pope was getting old. He was ready to pass on. And so he wanted to get his tomb commissioned. So it was. It was built by a prominent artist or sculptor. The problem was, when he died and it was unveiled, it was recognised. It's a very distinctive style. It's the style of a very well-known Protestant sculptor. Now, that caused a lot of concern to the cardinals. How can you have a Protestant with his artwork in St. Peter's? And they argued about it for 2 years. Do we take it out, or do we leave it there? You know what the conclusion was? We'll leave it there and turn it into the janitor's cupboard. Mops, brooms, and things like that are kept in it. Okay, I love this one. Actually, I wonder if the new Pope uses this. This is a confessional box. So the priest goes in there, and the poor confessor goes in there and shares the secrets through a little panel in the middle. Can you read that? Not very well. What does that say at the top? It's the Jesuit confession box. I wonder what secrets have been told inside that box over the centuries. Okay, we come around the corner, and there are these people who are bowing down to, kneeling down to, and praying to some artifact. I wonder what it is. There's nuns there, there's the faithful there, and they're praying to this artifact. So we got a little bit closer. You know what that is? It's an embalmed dead pope. It's a dead carcass. And they were praying to it. It's just extraordinary. That's him a little closer if you want to get acquainted. Okay. Well, that's it. But can you see, brothers and sisters and young people, why I say I came through there, in a sense, laughing with amazement that anybody could be fooled by that sort of system to think that it represents the things of God? I was just staggered by just how open and transparent it was. And God willing, it will be our privilege and pleasure to be able to blot that system out of the face of the earth, because it's drunk with the blood of the saints.